Hello everyone, it's Tom Slater here, editor of Spiked. We'll get into this episode of the Spiked podcast in just a moment. But before we do that, I just want to say a huge thank you to everyone who has donated to our Christmas appeal so far. As people who listen to this podcast or watch this podcast know, Spiked is completely free because we want anyone, anywhere to be able to engage with our ideas. But in order to keep Spiked free, we ask people who can afford it to donate to us to support our work. Your donations have never been more important, particularly given what a hostile environment the advertising world is to dissenting voices like ours these days. Indeed, even as our audience has gone up in recent years, our advertising revenue has actually gone down because there's a certain type of woke corporate who would rather pass up the opportunity to sell you things if it means they don't have to deal with the likes of us. But who needs them? More than 70% of our revenue now comes from our supporters and our donors. And as we're going into the Christmas period, we're asking people who maybe haven't donated before, maybe haven't donated for a while, or can maybe afford to donate just a little bit more, to dig deep for us this Christmas and to fund our work as we go into 2024. Your money really does make a huge difference. If everyone who read Spiked any given month gave us just £5 this Christmas, we could fund our work for 2 years and we could take Spiked to the next level. And rest assured, we've got a lot of really exciting stuff in store for you over the weeks and months ahead. So if you like what we do here at Spiked, if you support our work, if you know that the media is a much better place with us in it, please do give generously this Christmas. To do so, just go to spiked-online.com/donate. And please give generously, or if you want to make a donation of £50 or more, you can take the opportunity to get one of these beautiful free Spiked mugs, which we're offering to anyone who gives that amount, £50 or more, over the festive period while stocks last. It's for UK donors only, unfortunately. So if you want to get your hands on one of these, go to spiked-online.com/mug. That's spiked-online.com/mug. Thanks so much. We really wouldn't be here without you. And now on with the show.
Hello and welcome back to the Spiked podcast. I'm Lauren Smith, sitting in for Fraser this week. And joining me today is Tom Slater, editor of Spiked.
Hello.
And also with us is Dennis Kavanagh, the director of the Gay Men's Network.
Hi.
On this week's episode, we'll be discussing the silencing of gender-critical MPs, the return of blasphemy laws to Europe, and why eco-activists hate Christmas. So this week, we have seen Tory MP Rachel McLean get into a bit of trouble over a apparently controversial thing that she said. She pointed out the fact that one of the Green Party's MP candidates in Bromsgrove, Melissa Poulton, was in fact a biological man. And looking at any pictures of Melissa Poulton, I'm sure we'll probably insert some here for visual aids for our viewers. But Melissa Poulton is quite obviously a man in a wig. However, Rachel McLean's comments about him being a biological man appeared to have caused some upset. She was accused of being transphobic. She was called vile, hateful. She was even reported to the police for a supposed non-crime hate incident. Dennis, what do you make of this story? Have you been following it at all? What do you make of this?
I have been following it. And on one level, it's comedic because this is very clearly, exactly as Rachel McLean MP said, a bloke in a wig, but there is a really serious side to this story as well from a gay rights perspective. This guy calls himself a lesbian, right? And he demands everyone call him a lesbian. He says, in fact, he is a proud lesbian. No one ever asked lesbians if that was all right, okay? Everyone is kowtowing to this chap, using female pronouns for him, acquiescing to the proposition that he is a lesbian. This is grossly, grossly offensive to lesbians, because if you as a minority community lose the right to define yourself as what everyone knows a lesbian is, a same-sex attracted female, and if someone else comes in from the outside and redefines you as a constituency, that is the very essence of homophobia. And there's a second-order problem here. It recalls, I think, you know, the final words of 84, the party telling you to reject the evidence of your eyes and your ears. You can't say what you see. And the party in question here is the Green Party. So Rachel McLean is absolutely correct to, one, say what she said, and two, thank goodness, to stand up and to say, no, I have a right to say this. I have a Volstatter-style protected belief. But as I say, the particular axe I have to grind on this is, how dare this guy come in, this transvestite, and tell us that he's just redefined what a lesbian is? I can tell you now, certainly in the chat groups and the political work I do, lesbians are not tremendously happy with that.
Yeah. So, Tom, what have you made of this story?
No, I mean, I share a lot of Dennis's thoughts about it, and especially was the intervention of the police, I thought was so shocking. Now, it seems like she's been given one of these non-crime hate incidents, which is something that, of course, was supposed to end as a practice, but as we all know, that makes no difference with the blob that exists within the police or any of our institutions at the moment. They just carry on regardless. I mean, what is it that she, what hatred has she supposedly perpetrated in this instance? Is it hateful to point out the bleeding obvious? But unfortunately, that is the situation we've got into. And also, I just don't understand why even members of the police service are happy with a situation where they've effectively become the kind of rent-a-goons of various trans activists. This happens time and time again because of the fact that they know even if they can't get them on one of the already pretty vague and easy to abuse kind of hate speech and hate crime laws that we have, you can just get them with one of these non-crime hate incidents, which is a non-crime, so it doesn't, you don't actually have to have committed anything, but it's also entirely subjective, so it can be something that can haunt you forever. I think that's the key thing with so much of this, is that it's the willingness of institutions, of the authorities, the state even, to play along with this stuff. And not only just to play along with this stuff, but to mete out punishment on anyone who is willing to say what everyone else is thinking, is something which is so pernicious. And even in a situation like this, when it's so obvious that what this MP was saying was correct, it's just a reminder that of all of the great and genuine gains that have been made by the gender critical side, if we're going to call it that, over the course of the past few years, it's really difficult to dislodge this ideology, not least because of the hold it has within those kinds of institutions like the police. But I don't know what you think, Dennis, what it would take to kind of take us to that.
Well, I do think we are slightly further forward because I was talking about this today and I noticed Rachel McLean has doubled down and said, absolutely, I'm not apologising. I said what I said. And Rachel's been very, you know, moderate in this and said, look, I'm not going out to offend people. I'm not saying that trans people don't deserve respect. I'm just calling a spade here. But my view on this is 24 months ago, say, in this debate, I would have expected an apology and a climb down. Mm. And I think the discourse has markedly changed this week. The problem that we've got here is this Stonewall umbrella of trans, which just has everything under it. The Stonewall definition includes cross-dressers, is placing a veil of protection and a veil of civil rights over characters, frankly, who are not deserving of it. That Melissa Poulton is not so dissimilar to Eddie Izzard, right? Eddie Izzard is a heterosexual male transvestite, all right? He calls himself trans, but he does not have the same experience as, say, a post-surgical transsexual. Right? He does not have the same experience as someone struggling with crippling gender dysphoria. And it's this amalgam that's creating this sort of veneer of civil rights where it just shouldn't exist. Because I'm sorry, paraphilic cross-dressing is not uncommon as a heterosexual male fetish. And I do not understand why these heterosexual male fetishes are indulged to this extent. And I would point out that the homosexual variants, so, I don't know, going around in leathers or something like that, would never be indulged to this extent. This is a very powerful lesson about who really holds power in this society, in my view.
And it's not just Rachel McLean that has been in trouble this week. Kemi Badenoch has also found herself under fire, particularly by Labour MP Kate Osborne, who particularly took umbrage to the fact that last week Kemi Badenoch described this kind of massive increase of young people being referred to NHS gender identity service clinics as a epidemic. She said that it was almost epidemic. Mm. And she also talked a lot about this idea that, you know, young gay people are under threat by trans ideology, and it's kind of a new form of gay conversion therapy. And Dennis, you wrote about this for us at Spiked.
I did.
Why don't you talk a little bit about what's happened here with Kemi Badenoch?
Yeah, I mean, Badenoch delivered a bit of a game changer this week. She said the unsayable, and as she pointed out, it isn't a left-right issue, this. Everything she was saying was being echoed by left-wingers across the chamber as well, like Neil Hanvey MP, Joe Cherry. There's the grown-ups have come back into this debate and it scared the hell out of the people who normally silence and just try to cut off legitimate lines of debate. So we had Sir Chris Bryant in the chamber, a grown man, telling us that the words of the Secretary of State made him feel unsafe, which he went on to mock, in my view, quite justifiably, in committee. I thought that was a low base tactic to try and get her to feel guilty or say that she shouldn't have said what she said. And what Badenoch said was very important. She said, look, there is almost an epidemic of young gay children. She repeated it in a very sort of Neil Kinnock way, you know, young gay children turning up at these gender clinics. She is right. 5,000% increase in natal females between 2003-2013. 80 to 90% of the cohort are same-sex attracted. The staff there are saying this feels like a new form of gay conversion therapy. Anyone with their eyes open can see that this is a new form of gay conversion therapy. The detransitioners are providing harrowing evidence of this being a new form of gay conversion therapy. Badenoch herself spoke to Keira Bell, who brought the 2020 judicial review into the Tavistock. Surprise, surprise, Keira Bell's a lesbian. Well, that's no coincidence, right? So Badenoch, we've got a great inversion here. Badenoch is the one who is the gay rights hero. She's the one who's saying, I'm actually concerned about this. And she's being met by people who try and get her to feel guilty or try to vilify her. So Kate Osborne seizes on the word epidemic. She then misrepresents that in committee and says, you, quote, likened it to a disease. So she accuses the minister of using inflammatory language, but she herself goes for the most inflammatory language she can. And she says something which was not accurate, if I put it in those terms. She says in a letter, you likened trans people to disease. That's not true. Kemi Badenoch said there is an epidemic of presentations at this clinic. That's perfectly normal metaphorical use of language. But it's very telling about what the other side of this debate do. They have nothing of substance to say to the serious issue of actual gay conversion going on in our lifetime, which I fear that it has happened. They have nothing to say to that issue. So what do? They play language games.
And they're having to ignore also the mounting evidence, not just as you suggested in terms of the figures, but the reports from inside the Tavistock, the dark jokes that would be made about soon enough there's not going to be any gay people left as a consequence of what is taking place. And it's an incredible rights scandal, which has been completely ignored because, quote-unquote, trans rights apparently has to conquer everything before it. I was also quite struck in that committee meeting how when you actually see these kind of debates take place in a context like that, on the kind of trans ally, trans activist side, they never really send their best, do they? They're always incredibly poorly briefed. So when Badenoch is pushing back on Osborne very hard, you're a liar, I never said that. Where did I say that? She was like, that just was stumbling across. You think if you're going to make that kind of charge, you'd think you'd have done your homework, you'd have your kind of backup point. She couldn't say anything. And I think that speaks to the fact that, first of all, how this ideology has been unthinkingly absorbed by a section of society and politics who just want to feel like a good person. I think that goes for a lot of people on that committee, frankly. You know, they just want to look good at the right dinner parties, etc. Then there's also the fact that they are so unaccustomed to even the most minor pushback, which is why when someone like Badenoch, who's very clear in her views, has looked at this very closely, has met with all the people involved, and is not willing to back down easily, they just completely crumble. And that's a story that we've seen repeated time and time again, particularly when some of these trans activist groups have been having to account for themselves, say at a tribunal or in a courtroom or whatever, where they can't just do the no debate tactic, where they can't just run away, where they can't just turn to the person cross-examining them and accuse them of transphobia or something. So it was a really stark reminder, I think, of like how much can be achieved if just more people refuse to play along with that, to push back, to marshal the arguments and to say no, which I thought both in the House of Commons and in that committee, Kemi Badenoch was a very powerful example of how effective that can be when you just say no, stop, this is very important.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And as Badenoch said, we have to do better than this, right? We are talking here about clinical therapeutic provision for very, very troubled kids. Some of these kids are deep on the autistic spectrum. Some of them have been bullied. Some of them have been sexually abused. We're talking about a cohort here where we shouldn't be in a situation, and I fear that this is Kate Osborne's game, I'm afraid. We shouldn't be in a situation where someone is manufacturing clickbait for Twitter. I mean, Osborne said in advance of this, when I get to committee, I'll have a few questions for her. It's like, well, you know, this is the lives of young gay people, mate. I could do, you know, we could do better then this tit for tat, this party politics, this shouldn't be party political. We should all be able to look at the evidence and say there's too many autistic girls here, right? That's not a Labour Tory issue. That's a we have to do better as human beings issue. So I would agree with you. It's low quality stuff from that side. And I just lament that this is the case. It's like when Osborne unthinkingly said, Badenoch wants, and the government are looking at RHSC, so, you know, basically sex ed in schools, and they're concerned that some providers are teaching basically gender identity ideology. And of course, I say in passing, the kids most likely to be told you've got the wrong body and you need surgery are the ones who don't fit in, and they're more likely to be gays and lesbians, right? So when Badenoch is talking about that, Osborne hits back by saying, oh, that's the new Section 28. And I have to say, particularly as a gay person looking at that, I'm just like, please stop misusing our history, right? Because as I've just pointed out, the reforms here are designed to protect the very constituency you say you're protecting. So it's a complete inversion in the same way as, you know, as I said a minute ago, don't accuse other people of inflammatory language if you're going to say that they said the word disease. In fact, what she said was you liken them to disease, which she's now fallen back on today to say, well, I didn't actually say you use that word. It's like, well, you know.
These are the tactics on
well, something else, isn't it? It's something else.
What looks like the return of blasphemy laws to Europe. So Denmark, this happened late last week on Thursday, I believe. Denmark announced that it was passing a new law that is criminalising Quran burning. Now, it didn't explicitly say that you can't burn Qurans, but it did say that you are no longer allowed to improperly treat the books or texts that were sacred to religions. So obviously that includes the Quran, includes the Bible, includes all sorts of other holy texts. And it was also very obvious that Denmark passed this law with the Quran in mind. We've seen recently in Scandinavia, in general, a lot of cases where far-right groups, but also apostates, ex-Muslims, have been burning Qurans to make a political point. Tom, what have you made of this? Is this a massive setback for free speech in Denmark?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think it's a really depressing chapter in the story of the attempt to effectively kind of globalise Islamic blasphemy laws. I think this is something that kind of came and went without much discussion, apart from on places like Spikes, but is really, really central. So as you say, this is a thinly veiled Quran burning bill, effectively. It's now been signed into law. No one is really even pretending this isn't about anything but Quran burning. Even government officials in the Danish coalition government have said we are putting a stop to Quran burnings on social media. I thought there was a really striking quote that came from one of the spokespeople for the Moderate Party, who were part of the coalition there, who said, this is a law that we're passing not out of desire, but out of necessity. And that is such a tremendously depressing and revealing statement. So obviously the context here, not only have these Quran burnings taken place, but also as a consequence, both in Denmark and Sweden, you've seen the terror threat level rising precipitously. They've also had a lot of pushback from the leaders of Muslim majority countries in Iran. Both the Danish and the Swedish kind of diplomats were summoned in for addressing down. In Iraq, I believe both of their embassies were stormed as a consequence of all of this. The OIC, I should say, which is the Organization of Islamic Countries, has been essentially pushing for something to be done about these Scandinavian countries. And this is just a bold capitulation to those demands. It's a tearing up of hard-won Danish freedoms because theocrats elsewhere in the world or terrorists within their own country have decided that they're upset about people mocking what it is that they happen to believe or not showing due respect to a text that they happen to hold to. So I think it's really difficult not to see this as anything other than a really kind of stark chapter in the decades-long process, we might get into how long this story is, of the attempt to take Islamic blasphemy laws and effectively impose them by any means necessary. What I think we're seeing here is the shift from that being a kind of internalised thing. You know, it doesn't do to do that. You know, intense fear about blaspheming against this particular religion. The fact that it's now becoming kind of black and white letter law, I think, is something new and particularly troubling in that sense. Mm-hmm.
I mean, what do you make of this, Dennis? I don't know if you saw this. I should also say that not only is it now a crime to burn a Quran or religious text, but it also can be punished by a fine or up to 2 years in prison. So you could go to jail for up to 2 years for improperly treating a Quran in Denmark. So what have you made of this, Dennis?
I guess speaking of my legal hat on rather than the sort of gay rights hat, I find it extraordinary. One, I question the degree to which this is compliant with a human rights framework. I don't see how this fits with relatively well-known freedom of expression cases. It certainly wouldn't fit with British common law conceptions of freedom of speech. And I think of Lord Justice Sedley and DPP and Redmond Bate saying, you know, free speech includes the heretical, the obnoxious, and freedom of speech that doesn't offend people is not a freedom worth having. So I question the longevity of the law for that reason. I wonder to what degree that's going to be coherent with wider human rights obligations. That makes me in turn question why on earth a parliament would place itself potentially at risk of a declaration of incompatibility. I could only think that they may have considered it a short-term measure and end up with a few test cases. If that is the position, it's a very strange road to take, particularly if one looks at the jurisprudential history of Denmark, which abolished its last blasphemy laws, you know, quite a few years back. So it is, I think, correct to characterize it in the first place as a blasphemy law. But in the second place, I just wonder the degree to which that's actually viable, because I get the point about capitulation to other countries. But, you know, just as in the same way in the, say, immigration debate, people moan from the right generally, or we can't do anything because the human rights framework. Well, that framework is going to kick in here at some point. So just legally speaking, I wonder what the position here is.
And I think it's interesting as well just how often the kind of human rights framework has sort of failed in attempts to sort of defend freedom of speech, apart from in certain terms. I mean, it's interesting. I imagine the defence that's going to be made here, and there could well be a slightly less full fat version of this law in Sweden, where they've had similar kind of spate of Quran burnings. And also some of their citizens have been killed in a terrorist attack recently in Brussels, where the terrorist in question explicitly targeted them on the basis that it was Swedish. So we might see something similar here, but it seems like they're going to go down this kind of national security route, effectively, that allowing whether it's far-right agitators, whether it's anyone to do this, is in itself poses a kind of national security threat. So as we've seen time and again, sometimes these things can often count against any kind of meaningful pushback on the legal level. But I think it's a sort of reminder that we do have to fight these things out on the moral level as well. And that's where we've really been slipping, because, you know, this is not an alien problem to a place like the United Kingdom. I mean, we don't have blasphemy laws of the kind that have just been ushered in Denmark. But if you think about Batley Grammar, if you think about the teacher there, you know, still in hiding as a consequence of showing Muhammad cartoons to his students in a religious studies class about blasphemy, perfectly normal place to which to discuss that kind of material. And if you think also about what happened in Wakefield not too long ago, where that autistic schoolboy was expelled, subject to death threats, and his mother then had to go on a kind of apology tour around the local mosque as a consequence of him bringing a Quran into school and it getting knocked to the floor and being lightly scuffed. So we're very much in that stage of these things are not institutionalized in quite the way, but they are kind of already internalized in terms of how we deal with these things, that you almost don't need the law. But I think there is something still very symbolically significant about the fact that this is actually something that has now reached a statute in a Western country, and it being Denmark as well, given its kind of recent history from the Danish cartoons controversy in 2005, where there was, of course, a lot of equivocation amongst their cultural elites about that, the sort of thing that we saw in the UK with the Rushdie affair, you know, people saying, well, they probably shouldn't have done that, or it's a bit unseemly or whatever. But nevertheless, the state resisted any attempts to properly criminalise what Ellen's Posen had done. Through to, you know, relatively soon after the Charlie Hebdo attack, of course, there was the shooting in Copenhagen at an event where there was a Swedish cartoonist who had drawn Muhammad and seemed to be part of the reason that it was targeted. So they have definitely become one of those nations who have become a kind of flashpoint in this kind of Islamist, this sort of global Islamist campaign against freedom of speech and so on. So to see them capitulate and to see them do it via introducing these laws just feels like it has a really grim symbolic significance, I think.
And Tom, don't you think this is particularly chilling that it happened so close to the sentencing around the Samuel Paty case that we've seen this week.
Yeah, so this is an interesting development in that. So obviously Samuel Paty, the teacher, was beheaded in France in 2020 by a Chechen Islamist. There was this ongoing case, which is now resolved, where basically a bunch of teenagers who had some involvement in this killing. Essentially, there's one young woman in particular who essentially started a rumour about him, which spun out of control, part of the reason that he ended up being targeted in the way that he was. She wasn't actually in class the day in which the cartoons were supposedly presented, but she claimed that he asked the Muslim pupils to identify themselves and then to leave the room. This is kind of part of the spiral of rumours that led to him, to his death, as well as a number of young men, I believe, who have, on the day itself, seemed to be involved in basically telling the Islamist in question where he was. You know, is that him? Have you seen him around? All that kind of thing, taking money for doing so. So they've been handed basically a bunch of suspended prison sentences as a consequence of that. But it's a real reminder about why you cannot allow this kind of medieval intolerance into your society, because it creates these kind of moments of hysteria in which basically gossip and half-truths can spin completely out of control and leave to someone to lose their life. It's the sort of thing you see happening in Pakistan all the time now, which has a real problem with not only does it have kind of blasphemy laws per se, but as a consequence of blasphemy being taken so seriously in that country, you very quickly have a lot of hate and violence being whipped up against individuals who, even if they've been falsely accused of blaspheming or of being heretics or what have you. And I think it is very important to note that when we talk about making sure that blasphemy laws don't make a comeback, whether informally or formally in this country, that is as much about protecting Muslim communities as it is about protecting the rest of British society, if you like. The only death that I'm aware of in the last 10 or 15 years in the UK as a consequence of blasphemy was an Ahmadi Muslim in Glasgow. It was a man called Asad Shah. People have kind of forgotten about this story. It was in 2016. There was a lot going on that year, but still. Because the Ahmadis are seen by many Muslims as essentially heretics. And as a consequence of this, in videos he put out online, a man from Bradford went up there and essentially stomped him to death. So it's a reminder that these things, when they allow to get out of control, this attempt to kind of impose these sort of Islamic blasphemy laws, we should resist it as much for the minorities within minorities as it is for anyone else in British society. So one, I think that's really important to take heed of, particularly with the example of, you know, ex-Muslims as well. So I think all of those people, liberal Muslims, ex-Muslims, members of dissenting sects, are as much in the firing line, if not more so, than the rest of British society or Danish society or whatever, when you allow these things to take hold. And I think that's important to remember when we talk about this issue.
So for our final topic today, something a little bit festive.
Bit of light relief.
Yeah. Exactly.
After that.
So the sort of German offshoot of Extinction Rebellion, Letzte Generation, have started this week vandalising Christmas trees all across the country in Germany. In cities, in public spaces across Germany, they have been spray painting Christmas trees in that distinctive, as we're used to in the UK, Just Stop Oil orange. And they say that they're doing this to sort of bring people's awareness away from the festivities and back to the fact that we are on the brink of heat death, supposedly. This is also the same group that last year managed to cut the top off of Berlin's very famous 15-metre high Christmas tree. They sawed the top off the Christmas tree. And Just Stop Oil in the UK have also promised that they're going to start taking similar action. So, Dennis, what do you make of this? What is it about Christmas that really gets these people so fired up?
Merry Christmas. Yeah. Just Stop Oil. I mean, they're just so joyless, this lot, sometimes, aren't they? There is, I'm afraid, it's a stream of green politics that is rather doomsday cultish, that is rather sanctimonious, and is absolutely determined to stamp all over anyone experiencing anything approaching joy. And it's so heavy-handed, and it's so, you know, your betters telling you what's good for you. And the comedy is only heightened by the fact they've all got Downton Abbey style, really posh names, you know, Chiara and Tristan descending from their manor to tell you, don't you dare enjoy Christmas. And look, I'm not saying there aren't genuine environmental concerns here and there, but I find the joylessness of this movement and the upper bourgeois middle class mechanisms of this movement really irritating. Going into museums and ensuring that artworks which are there to edify, to lift the spirits, which are open to the working classes to go and see for free, you know, making sure that the joy you can experience from art is a no-go because Chiara and Tristan are wagging their fingers at you, doing the same now for Christmas. I find their choice of targets instructive, joyless, and about as much fun as a doomsday cult, which is sort of what they are. They morphing into in my personal opinion. I should say I'm not speaking on behalf of the organisation. That's just Kavanagh's view of it. Can I also add, by the way, I've always regarded green politics as the progenitor of gender, and I find them very, very interesting because there's this sanctimony, this joylessness. Mm-hmm. My enemy is not just incorrect, they are morally wrong. I am a hero and I am on a crusade. One maps onto the other perfectly. It's why all the green parties go along with gender. It's got the same rhythm as a philosophy.
No, completely. And it seems to attract a number of the same people as well, you know? you can almost imagine them on sort of gender ideology demonstration one day and then gluing themselves to something in the name of the climate the next day. Yeah. And in both cases, they're not really sending their best often. But yes, it's the puritanical aspect of it, which is so striking. It does feel like chopping off the tops of Christmas trees and spraying them with orange paint because people aren't paying enough attention to the serious issues as far as they're concerned. It is the perfect embodiment of that H.L. Mencken quote about Puritans being gripped by the fear that someone somewhere might be enjoying themselves.
Yeah,
you know?
That's right.
It's a perfect example of that. And I think there's a reason why green politics often takes on this very puritanical form, why it has been targeting people's leisure activities, whether it's the snook or whether it's the Christmas market. You've written on Spike this week, Lauren, about the strange way in which every year now we seem to have this kind of spate of articles saying things like Christmas is, you know, a kind of is the worst thing for the environment, the Christmas markets are killing the planet, all the glitter's going to get into the water supply, all of these things just one after another. And I think it just speaks to the fact that, you know, underneath the often very overheated claims, pardon the pun, about the climate and what's going to happen in the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years, you know, young people claim they've got no future when that's almost certainly not going to be the case, however you read the data. It's driven by something else. Like, there is this kind of desire, on the one hand, a discomfort with sort of material abundance and developed society. They have this kind of very sort of chocolate box view of what it would be like to live a more natural, in line with nature kind of life, which I think is a lot easier to think that kind of thing when you do come from quite a well-off background. But the other thing is just the joylessness. Like, they are slightly irritated by the notion that things in life can be a bit frivolous, that you might buy things you don't always need in that sense, you know. That, you know, people might take pleasure in the sort of simple things in life and that they don't have to take everything so seriously all of the time. There's that kind of sackcloth and ashes sort of nature to environmentalism seems really wired in, really, you know. And I think you're just seeing the most ridiculous, unintentionally absurd expression of it in people going around cutting down Christmas trees and thinking that's going to gain them any sort of popular support as a consequence.
Yeah, it's the class aspect that really gets me. You do not hear working class voices on Just Stop War. What you hear, very, very, very privileged people, deeply, deeply, deeply middle class people. There's a sort of bourgeois insecurity with the way, as you say, the built environment and the lived world is working out, and it's almost like the leisure classes have decided, as I say, as a class flex, to go out and lecture what they believe to be their social inferiors. I mean, they really are wagging the finger. They really are. You know, we understand that, you know, you're all going to die better than you do. It's extraordinary, and it's a sort of paradigm for our age, because you see this again and again and again. You see elite sort of projects speaking down to the great unwashed, and gender is another good example of that, where you've got a sort of elite class, particularly in the third sector, speaking down to people. So I regard this as a manifestation of sort of, I don't know, bourgeois insecurity, really. That's what it is. And it's a an assertion of power over social inferiors.
No, I think that's right. And also, it's not just an ad hominem to say this. I mean, it's like a measurable fact. Like there was a, there was a study that was done, I think it was the first round of Extinction Rebellion arrests. And so some academics looked at who was going through the system and they kind of looked at what their demographic background was, what their educational background. They are overwhelmingly southern middle class university educated. I think something like 80%, north of 80% of them have a degree. And what's interesting is that it, even in green politics as well, even the kind of old aristocracy is relatively well represented. I think one of the Extinction Rebellion co-founders is like the daughter of a baronet or something. Or I should say that they be of a baronet. I think she's non-binary, incidentally. So it speaks to your point.
Oh my God, that makes perfect sense.
Speaks to your point about how all these things work. But no, I completely agree. If you are of a kind of, either a sort of self-flagellating bourgeois type or someone of a more sort of aristocratic background, you can understand why this movement would appeal to you, because you don't understand what actually material difficulty is like. You have no appreciation for how good things are when things are actually developed and you're living in a more plentiful society. But there is also, and I imagine this speaks more to the aristocratic side, the desire to go back to things maybe when people knew their place a bit more. I dare that is a bit more ad hominem, but I dare say that plays a bit of a role in this.
I just think the other aspect of this, the one that does worry me, seriously speaking, particularly with young people caught up in this, is the degree to which they genuinely believe, you know, there is no future for us on this planet. We are a sort of scourge on this planet. It would probably be better if we weren't here, and the planet is boiling. I think we had a sort of flavour of that when I was growing up in the 80s, but it wasn't anything like this. I mean, the worst of it was sort of acid rain and a hole in the ozone layer. It is now at the stage where some young people genuinely believe, you know, we do not have a future, we're all going to boil. And that is, I think, firmly in the realms of doomsday stuff. The end of the world is nigh. And I do think that some of the messaging on this, as, you know, the catalyst of social media makes messages across all sorts of debates more and more and more extreme, I do think that it's actually a cruelty to visit that on young people, and for young people to believe that and to visit that hopelessness on young people. So I do, you know, I do wonder the degree to which these guys actually think about that, because I wish they would. It's not very nice. It's my view. Be more nice. Anyway, still makes you proud to be British, though, to have such posh protesters, doesn't it? You know, I mean, what other country has baronets and stuff? It's like Downton Abbey.
Thank you for listening to the Spike podcast. We're back every Friday, and you can now watch us on video too. Check us out on YouTube or go via the Spiked website, which is spiked-online.com. See you next time.